You're listening to WCOM LP 103.5 FM Carborough and Chapel Hill. It's a Tuesday, it's 5 o'clock, and that only means one thing. It's time for another round of Snarky Faith with your host, Stuart Deloney. This is a space where we irreverently wrestle through life, culture, and spirituality, all with our heads in the clouds, our tongues in our cheeks, our hearts in our sleeves, and our feet on the ground. At Snarky Faith, the questions or even the answers are never the point. It's all about the conversation. So here's your host, Stuart Deloney.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to another round of Snarky Faith. I'm your host, Stuart Deloney, and Snarky Faith is radio for the spiritually disenfranchised. If you've had enough of the insanity in Christianity, you've come to the right place. Here at Snarky Faith, we're all about finding a sane faith grounded in reality and working to make the world a better place in tangible ways. This is not a zone for spiritual escapism, Sunday school answers, or Christianese. We're here to call it religious BS and look for better ways forward. And today, actually the day of recording this is Memorial Day. And I felt like we needed to have a good old conversation about pacifism and nonviolence on Memorial Day. I'm also saying this as you are listening to this, which you'll all, by the time you listen to this, it'll already be June. So let me begin the show by also saying Happy Pride Month. Happy Pride Month, everyone. So if you're new to the show, this is not a regular Snarky Faith episode whatsoever. Because what I'm doing here is I'm cracking into the old Snarky Faith vaults to actually bring back a conversation, an episode many, many moons ago, many, many years ago, back in 2015, when the show had a totally different even format. And this is where I'm sitting down with my good friend, Professor Ben, and talking about the ways of pacifism and nonviolence and why we need to restore those as ethics into the Christian faith. I'm tired of an American Christianity that seems to love militarism and guns and everything along that nature, which, hey, hold a second, I think we need to have a conversation about why this doesn't really make sense. So yes, the format may be different, but the snark is still the same. So I think you're going to have a great time listening to this. And I'll catch you guys again next week with the regular show, back with the regular format. But I hope everyone has a fantastic week ahead. And hey, again, happy Pride Month. I'll catch you guys next week. Enjoy the vintage Snarky Faith. Here we go! Well, good afternoon, Chapel Hill, Carborough, and everybody else that doesn't fit into those two categories. I'm your host, Stuart Deloney. We're here for another round of Snarky Faith Radio, and joining me, as always, is my trusty co-host, Professor Ben. Ben, how goes it, my friend?
Hey. It goes.
It goes.
It goes and goes.
It goes on a hot day in Carborough today. It's 88 out there. It's beautiful, but
yeah,
starting to get sticky.
Oh, my friend, it's going to get much worse as the summer goes on.
I know. I feel like I'm living in a fairy tale land right now because it's been so nice. We haven't even put, like, air conditioning has not come on in our house yet.
Yeah, that's the best. Open the windows. Smells nice.
Yeah, I think it's more of like just a personal challenge in our heads for my wife and I, because it always feels like failure once you have to flip on the air conditioning.
Yeah. I sweat at the drop of a hat, though, so I don't do well at night. It has to be a really nice, like, 70, 65 or something outside, or else I will become moist.
Moist, okay. And that's not, and we're not talking about any bedwetting
issues.
Not
in a naughty way. No, yeah, no, just the sweat glands.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's cleansing. Is it a cleansing thing?
It probably is, yeah.
Yeah, you're letting out toxins.
Toxins, yeah.
All right, well, let's
lots of toxins.
Let's hop into the show. And to kind of be slightly thematic now that we are on our descent into summer, and I know kids here in the area.
I like
area,
that it's a descent.
It is.
It's not an ascent.
It's unscented. I don't know. It just feels like it's...
It's definitely not unscented.
That is very true.
Not on my end.
But with, at least, no, I was thinking of it from the perspective of school being out in like 2.5 weeks. And so everything feels like a descent, at least if you've got kids around, to where it's just kind of that last little push to get done, where their brains have already been checked out for a month at least. But so what I wanted to do is I wanted just to have us to kind of kick off the show, because now this is the weather where you're going to have people laying poolside, going on vacation and everything else like that. And I thought we should do an unofficial or official, whichever way we want to call it, summer reading list from Snarky Faith.
and just giving some, this is not exhausted by any means, but it's just a few.
Mine is.
Yours is exhausted. Okay. which I do. I see you've got like a stack of paper in front of you. You have many and many. And no, but a summer reading list for those who care to be enlightened, maybe on that list or things like that too. I don't know. I brought three and mine are kind of a smattering across the board of stuff like that. So Ben, what do you have on your summer reading list to potentially recommend to others?
Okay. We go to the beach every year and my family lambasts me for what I read at the beach, but I brought War and Peace a couple years ago and they're just like, why?
That's
not a beach book.
That's why you're the intellectual, Ben. That's why you're Professor Ben.
That's not true. I just don't. There are so many books out there. I don't want to waste my time with one that I'm not exactly sure on. So I would rather knock out some of the ones that the historical community has agreed upon, at least Western people have agreed upon as good books. That's not necessarily what I'm throwing out today. But,
okay. But at least this list from you, you take this seriously. You have a passion for a summer reading list.
Oh, yeah.
And so this has all been vetted.
Yes.
So let hit me with your best shot.
So
fire away.
With the recent advent of Thomas Pynchon in the cinema with Inherent Vice, which came out a couple months ago, I was really excited about that. I figured I'd just throw out my favorite book. And I mean, it's very short. If you want to get into Thomas Pynchon, it's a great book to start. It's called The Crying of Lot 49. Mm. I don't want to give away anything about the title. It's basically like a lot of his books. There's a lot of paranoia and there's a mystery that unravels as things go on. Unlike his other books, there's actually a somewhat linear plot in this one. And there's this conspiracy that's boiling underneath, but you're never sure whether or not the conspiracy is real. So there's this paranoia that's in the background. Love that book. So that's my short, and I mean, it's like 150 pages.
That's the short and sweet version right there. Okay, so what do you got next?
I kind of step up to the next one. I want to throw out some Kierkegaard for people, but this is an entry-level Kierkegaard. It's not, you know, like a Danish sentence of compound words that runs on for 10 pages.
Okay.
It's called Training in Christianity. And really, I almost wish that every Christian ever would read this book. Mm. I really think it should be a requirement for getting into the Christian circle. Like before baptism, you have to read Training in Christianity by Soren Kierkegaard.
I have not read it, and so that probably should be an entry point for me to be your friend.
Yeah, you're outside of the circle.
Okay, I still have my checklist towards friendship. Sorry, I'm working on that one.
Yeah, you need to fill that out.
So you got Kierkegaard, and why do you love that?
It's just I think it's his. It gives a very straightforward view of Christianity for him and of Jesus and the role that Jesus played. There are a lot of great metaphors in it. And it's, again, it's not the type of book, you know, he wrote some sermons and things that are also really accessible, but this one is just a straightforward view of his view of Christianity. And I think it's fantastic. It's had a huge impact on my life. So
would you say it's like an existentialist's approach to Christianity?
Yeah, there's definitely a bend. Even though one of my pet peeves is that people call Kierkegaard the father of existentialism. I just don't know if he would claim that for himself because he's not an, and we'll get into this today, but he's not an ist person. He's not an ism person.
And it's hard to father something when you're always on the outside.
That's true. Yeah. And probably most existentialist philosophers, even though they draw a lot on Kierkegaard, always discount him for being a Christian. So that's the part at which they cut him off. Mm-hmm. They'll quit reading at that point. So that's book number two.
Number three,
throw down the big one, The Gauntlet. Because I feel like he doesn't get a lot of credit, but Gilles Deleuze, I don't even know if I'm saying that correct. And Felix Guattari, again, I don't speak French, but so they wrote a book called Anti-Oedipus, Capitalism and Schizophrenia. And just like Nietzsche wrote the Antichrist, which was his book basically detailing this sort of fascism of guilt and sin and morality in mm-hmm. his world that allowed sort of weak people to rise up. Mm-hmm. Deleuze and Guattari have written this book, Anti-Oedipus, which basically uses that sort of anti-Christ symbol, but it's against the Oedipal identity. And so the idea that people grow up in these sort of fixed identities of, you know, the Oedipal family of the father and the mother, and the father represents like the law or this thing that stands over you. And then the mother is this nurturing, mm-hmm. you know, desire that you miss for the rest of your life. And they just want to shatter that into pieces. And they tie it to capitalism, materialism, and it's really wonderful. I'm the type of person that I had a professor tell me once that if you're strong enough in your Christian identity, you're not scared to pick up a book and read it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just because Deleuze is a materialist, I don't think you're going to lose anything by reading this book. So it's a fantastic book.
So but that one is the kind of deeper waters.
Yeah,
that
one's going to take you a while. And I mean, if it doesn't, then you need to chew on it a little bit more. So but I love books like that. I mean, I like to have at least one book that's going to outlast the summer.
So those are good choices. Mine are, I feel like yours are a little more timeless. I was kind of going really over thinking about what have I read over like the last 6 months and kind of what has come to the surface and when I shake those down. So I think the first one, if you're going for any kind of soul food, I typically always run to Henry Nouwen anyways. And so, yeah, I've gone through this book Reaching Out, and it's about like three spiritual movements in your life. And it's just, I don't know. Henry Nouwen is just, you sometimes have those authors that feel like they just speak directly like to your soul type mm-hmm. of one of those ones. Oh, where you're yeah, like, absolutely. Oh yes. Like, oh, how does he know this about me type of a thing too. And Nouwen's always
patron saint.
He's really always been my patron saint to go through. And so, yeah, they just kind of talk about, I mean, he talks about in this that, you know, different movements in our life. So the movement from loneliness to solitude, the movement from hostility to hospitality, and then the last one from illusion to prayer. And really just going through stuff. And it's one of the reasons I really like Nouwen is because I feel like he's one of those authors that's very succinct. Mm-hmm. So he says a lot in very little words.
Yes.
So for
he's
for,
a sage.
For something for him for you to be able to pick up quickly, that's good soul food that won't take you that long to read. And it's one of those ones you can kind of pick it up and put it down as you're going through it. Mm-hmm. To in order to process it. I thought that was a good one. Yeah. And the second one, I am not typically a big reader of of fiction in general. And I'm not against fiction. I just tend to read stuff that ends up being more, I don't want to say the word practical, but kind of just brain food in that way. And I've loved the imagination of my kids because most of them are fairly just avid readers and just tear through stuff. And so when I hear them begin to talk about stuff, they usually come to me with asking like, what's next to read? And so I began to look up some stuff and I stumbled onto this book called Red Rising by Pierce Brown. Total like kind of sci-fi action adventure type stuff. And it was one of those ones, I haven't had an experience like this in a while for a book. Cause it's not small. It's somewhere like 450, 500 pages. And I found myself like reading it in 2 or 3 days. The first one, and I was lucky enough that he'd already written the second one at this time, so I was able to take it back to the library, get the next one, and chew through that in about 3 days. Still, the second one, Golden Sun, very, very good, and now I'm just angry because the last book doesn't come out until, like, spring, and so it was. It's one of those movies that's written well that you can kind of watch going, like, oh, I could totally see them making this into a movie, and it would actually be pretty good. Mm-hmm. Unless they screw it up.
Isn't it nice to read the book before the movie's made? So you're not one of those people.
That read the other way around?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm totally that person. I do that all the time. I'm like, oh, that was a good movie. I need to read the book.
Yeah. So that one, that was very, very good. I love it. And the last one, which I think will begin to lead us into our deeper conversation today, is one that's kind of been, I've been just slowly, it's not a long book, but I've just been slowly chewing my way through it. And it's called Farewell to Mars by Brian Zahn. And it's really about taking a different ethic towards looking at faith and war and violence and things of that nature. And Zahn goes into really picking out kind of what happened to Christianity, a lot of it, once it got married with Roman culture, with Constantine, and begins to kind of look through the eyes of what does it look like to be a nonviolent person. I mean, not that we're violent people, but to practice the ethic of nonviolence in a faith of Christianity where we live in a culture where, and we've talked about this endlessly on the show, but to where it seems like that Christianity has ends up being intertwined with politics and a lot of politics involved leads us to war, and war a lot of times is just about other than great means. I don't know. They're very politically minded means that go to that. And so Zahn does a really good job of kind of picking apart the things that we think that we say is Christianity and the things that really have just been culture. Mm-hmm. And that would be my list. So all right. Henry Nouwen's Reaching Out, Pierce Brown's Red Rising, and Farewell to Mars by Brian Zahn. And so with that, I wanted to jump in to our conversation today about nonviolence and or pacifism. So are you buckled up and ready to go, Ben?
Yeah. This is out of my realm of expertise for sure. I don't really know if I have a realm of expertise, but this one's definitely far, far left of things that I've thought deeply about in my life.
Well, and I like to throw this out too for all of our listeners out there, just to know that you can catch this episode and last episodes in like www.snarkyfaith.com. And even on there, you can email us questions at snarkyfaith.com. So if we're going in areas that you're like, these dudes are totally wrong, or I like that and add to it. Yes. So by no means are we experts, but really, like we say in the intro here, we really find the idea of conversation and dialogue and wrestling through it a very important process. And so we are going to really step into what does pacifism, what does an ethic of non-violence look like in a perspective of a Christian faith, and is that a component that should be part of your faith? And so I began by talking a little bit about Brian Zahn. And Brian Zahn is a speaker, he's a pastor, he's an author, and what he really, I think, began to get out, which I thought was very interesting with this. And one thing that he was a little turned off at when you begin to label people being a pacifist, and when you begin to put people in the camp of saying, oh, you're a pacifist, that you somehow have kind of hopped into that box, and then that box begins to define you. And so a lot of what he likes to talk about within that, because when you say pacifism, it's often wrapped up in politics as well, too. Like that's mainly, I think, the term is typically used in a political setting. And when we begin to use it in a faith setting, we need to use different terms. And so I think some of this, we may bounce them back through the terms, but I think we're just really talking about an ethic of nonviolence within that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need to throw out where that idea came from.
Ben,
that on the table.
Professor Ben, let's where did this idea of not being put in a box come from?
Yeah, it's Kierkegaard. Yeah. He quotes Kierkegaard here. Says, when you label me, you negate me. That's been an important little phrase for me. Hmm. Just because, and I know that I think people are familiar with this idea of, you know, don't call me this or don't call me that. I'm more than that, but even beyond that, I think it's more for what you think about yourself as mm-hmm. that type of, you know, whatever ist or ism. So as a pacifist, a lot of times when people say that, it's reinforcing their identity mm-hmm. and their commitment is to kind of telling people that they're that, or showing people mm-hmm. that they're that. And I think maybe what Zahn's getting at here and what you were talking about is it's more of, what does that decision mean? Like, what does it require of you? Mm-hmm. What does that decision mean to you as a person? Not what does it mean to the person you just told walking down the street, or you got on Facebook mm-hmm. and I had a friend that actually did that. Actually had plenty of friends going through Duke Divinity School that decided that they wanted to be pacifists, or that they were pacifists, they should be. Mm-hmm. But it really became more of an intellectual exercise. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that I followed every single person around and watched to see what they would do, mm-hmm. but that really informed my opinion of pacifism, that I started to ask, how is this relevant? Mm-hmm. Like, what is this? What sort of decisions do you make on a daily basis that require you to be a pacifist? Mm-hmm. And I think for some people, it does lead to, you know, not wanting to be in selective service, or not paying taxes and things like that. And mm-hmm. for some people, it does become maybe like a voting issue or something like that.
Sure.
But to me, some of those. Now, if you don't pay your taxes, then you're hardcore. That you're gonna have the government coming knocking down your door.
You're living off the grid somehow.
Right. Yeah. There are definitely like consequences of that. But some of these other things, I really wonder how much it requires of people versus finding ways that connects with you and letting that be a relevant question. So if you do find yourself, and I do think there are definitely people in the world that question can be a very, or that stance, a nonviolent stance can be a very significant thing in their life to comport themselves to nonviolence is going to require a ton of them.
Yeah.
So I had a professor at UNC who fought in the Eritrean Civil War when they seceded from Ethiopia. And to hear his just description of his life during that period of time, for him to stand up and obviously he wasn't a pacifist, but for him to stand up and say, I'm going to be a pacifist in this moment, requires so much of him. It's so relevant to his life at that moment. Or people in Eastern Europe in the 90s and in Serbia and places like that, or even now in certain countries in the Middle East and Africa. And I mean, there's violence going on there. Now, to me, I mean, I do live in Durham, but I still don't feel like there's violence. I've never seen violence in Durham.
Well, I think you hit like the nail on the head with a lot of this. When people begin to talk, when you hear the word pacifism, you think of just the initial idea of just you're anti-war. And I think when you begin to just say it on that level, that really, like you're saying, unless you're in certain geographical areas, that's not something that you're necessarily confronted with on a regular basis. But I think when you begin to take it to the level of nonviolence, I think you could begin to look of in smaller areas in your life, like where does violence occur? What does violence look like in my sphere? It may not look like me needing to protest, you know, a war or a war zone type of a thing, because it ends up being one of those things I think that happens. And yes, I'll just throw this out in a totally like blanket judgmental way, but a lot of times when I hear people talk about it, it ends up being one of those things that you use at cocktail parties or you hear like around coffee shops. You know, it's one of those things that kind of, I don't know, people like to identify with themselves or wear t-shirts or bumper stickers, but it ultimately requires very little of them, especially living in America. We're not necessarily confronted with that on a day-to-day basis.
And in some situations, it actually helps you. I think it actually would augment your social standing. So I've noticed recently, at least in the area in which we live, around college campuses and, like you said, coffee shops and things like that, to take some sort of stance that someone feels is outside of social norms actually, I guess, helps you in some way. I mean, you really are trying to be more interesting to people. So there is that aspect of it, but yeah, I mean, definitely where I'm from, if you were to march around saying I'm a pacifist, people would just think you're crazy or that you're a, you know, left wing nut job or something like that. So, I mean, I do think that there are definitely places where to stand up and say, you know, I'm a pacifist or, that does have social ramifications, but even then, how much does that cost of you? Obviously, if you're announcing to people what you are, then you don't really care what they think of you. And so beyond that, again, I ask, what does this cost you in your life?
Well, and I think that we bring this up because part of what we go after here on the show is to be able to talk about stuff that ends up being relevant towards faith and culture within that. And I think that when so often, and that's, hey, I'll just go ahead and say this. One of my reasons for even doing this show is to be able to give a different spin to what faith looks like in America. In a way that when most people think of evangelical Christianity or just Christianity as a whole, if you take a step back from that, we end up thinking of it being some sort of a patriotism, love of government. We're founded by a Christian nation, all those blah, 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 blah. And so part of the goal for this is to be able to allow people to look at this from a different angle, begin to say, wait, it doesn't have to be just like that. And I think when we start to look at this in a way, and Zahn, I think, he makes a really interesting point in this article talking about, you know, one, that pacifism is a political position, like that's on violence. But, you know, for us, and I think that's what you were saying with the isms, like to be able to be someone that follows after the way of Jesus, you begin to have to say, you know, I'm a Jesusism or something, you know. Yeah. I mean, like that, and that you're
a Christian.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's kind of like,
but I'm a Christist.
It almost sounds like you're cursing somehow. Christish, you know. No, but you begin to have like a system of ethics that of things that are kind of the pillars on what you begin to live around. And so I think then for someone to say that they follow Jesus, I think we have to begin to look at this, because I think in our culture today, where you think of Christianity as being right wing, conservative, you know, the Republican thing. And I know that's stereotyping, but it just gives us a talking point to move from, really to look at this, to advocate for nonviolence, to advocate for a different way of living. It really goes back to that whole counterculture way of Jesus. And I think so much, or so often, if you are an observer of culture, I think that you can see Christianity as anti-culture and not counterculture. And I think those are two very different distinctions to be had with that. And I think that when you're anti-culture, you're really just out against it. But I think to be counter culture, you're still very well immersed in it.
Mm-hmm. You're responding to it.
Yes, you're responding to it. You're immersed in it.
Sticking your head in the sand and being reactive to everything.
Yeah, making, you know, castle walls and moats, you know, ways to separate yourself, but you're actually looking to be able to have a different ethic and kind of on how you live. And I think when we come to this, we begin to look at Jesus as a person that would advocate nonviolence. And we'll get to the detractors of this school of thought a little bit later in it. But when I was reading through some stuff I had never thought about this, and the reason I have you on the show, Ben, is because you are a much wiser scholar than I, and so
I already told you this is way out of my field of,
and you legitimize my folly within it. But he began to construct a whole ethic, but he construct an argument around when you begin to look at Palm Sunday, and I've never really heard it preached in this way, where you have, for those of you that know, Palm Sunday is a Sunday. If you're going to do it chronologically, Palm Sunday on the liturgical calendar is a Sunday that happens before Easter, and it signifies the time where Jesus began to ride into Jerusalem, was greeted as, you know, as the Messiah, as the Savior. You have people cheering, they're laying down palm branches, and it ends up being this huge kind of crescendo, especially if you've been reading through the Gospels, on, wow, like, look at what we're building towards here in Jesus's kind of campaign or ministry, or however, you know, way you want to put this. But when you begin to look at it, it was, digging a little deeper into it, it was the Jewish people at this point of saying, finally. You know, they've lived under many different versions of captivity through many different captors. And at this point in time, we find the Jews under the captivity of Rome. And they began to see this as this idea of this Messiah or Savior. Finally, you're going to deliver us from this kind of occupation. You know, looking back to the whole time of, and I hadn't even thought of this, but really kind of this, it's kind of an echoing this whole patriotism, this remembrance of what happened with the Maccabean revolt for this. And so this was this huge time that was full of hope, but it was hope that was hopefully geared towards violence.
Overthrowing the government. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because...
in violent means.
I mean, basically, like, when a Roman general would have a victory, he would ride back in on a horse, like this beautiful steed, and mm-hmm. people would throw him a parade. And this is... you know, Jesus coming in on a donkey and really hasn't, I guess, technically done anything outside of the healings and, you know, his sort of ground ministry, foot ministry. And so, yeah, it's really a subversive image, the Palm Sunday image, because it's really embarrassing if you think about it, because, I mean, instead of a Roman, first of all, you'd be a Roman general who's mm-hmm. famous and has just beat down someone, some country or some city, and you're riding in on this beautiful horse. It's this little Jewish guy who has kind of a folk following, and you're riding in on a nasty donkey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, huge contrast to that.
Right. So, yeah, it's definitely subverting the image of overthrowing governments and military victory. There's actually a great book I could throw on the summer reading list.
Oh, throw it on there.
By Kevin Rao, called World Upside Down. I think that's the name of it, which is his version, his view, his reading of Luke, Acts. And one of the points he makes very strongly in that book is that, and he definitely makes this point through Luke did not see Jesus as a zealot. And so the Maccabees would be a zealot.
Yeah.
would be zealots. And zealots, you know, are passionate about overthrowing the government through violent means. Mm-hmm. Jesus is not depicted that way in Luke Acts. Mm-hmm. But he does overturn the world order. That's what's so interesting about mm-hmm. Jesus. He doesn't have to do it through violence. Mm-hmm. So I think that's relevant to this conversation.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Definitely read Kevin Rao.
Well, but with that, what's funny, and I think that's what begins to happen today, and I think that we miss this a lot of times, and I throw this out there for those of you that kind of like to look on from the outside of Christianity or have looked at it and said, because many a times I said, or much worse. But we are regulated by the FCC, so is what you'll get from me. And
I don't know how that
game
was relevant.
Over.
I just wanted to throw that in.
No. but looking at that, I think that you begin to also see these parallels that begin to happen where Jesus is absolutely misunderstood by people that are saying they follow him mm-hmm. in this, you know, to where, you know, they're looking at this as like, oh, hey, this is our agenda. This is going to be filled with violence and it's going to give us what we want.
Right.
And I think that if you look back over the history of Christianity, I think there's times where those same things continue to rear their ugly head over and over where you begin to not see, you know, this whole, you know, idea of Jesus being a nonviolent person and that change happens through this new way that this idea of the kingdom of God happens through a community of people that hopefully hold to an ethic of nonviolence and doing something different, which we'll get into that in a minute. But you begin to see all these other ones that are like, yay, we're on this bandwagon because we're going to get this stuff that we want. And I think that you see that happening in our country today. And I know this is not the point of this whole thing, but I think there's an interesting parallel between what they were seeing Jesus as back then and what a lot of folks see Jesus as today. And I think that many times, even within faith circles, I think we misunderstand stuff or we just interpret Jesus the way we want to interpret Jesus.
Yeah, and Zahn brings up this point about violent movies, how in his youth he enjoyed violent movies and cowboy justice held a romantic appeal. Mm-hmm. And I get this because, so I grew up liking The Karate Kid mm-hmm. and then moved on from that to kung fu movies just in general, which literally have the same plot. Every kung fu movie has the same mm-hmm. plot. There's a Padawan trainee, and then this person has a master, then the master dies, and then the person learns some new move through special training and then goes and kills whoever killed his master. Mm-hmm. So it's always retributive justice. Mm-hmm. And I think 80s action movies were modeled on that story. I'm sure there are lots of Westerns and things that have that because it really is satisfying. There's a moment in the beginning of the movie where you are hooked because you want to see someone die. You're mm-hmm. like, this is not fair. I'm going to watch for an hour and a half until this person dies. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah, because it feels good.
And that's what I feel like the Jewish people at that point, you know, they had gone through so much oppression. And even with you mentioned the Maccabean Revolt. Mm-hmm. I mean, at that point, there's this man named Antiochus Epiphanes that comes in and sets up these idols and things in the temple, the Jewish temple, and just, I mean, it defaces it. It's a giant middle finger to the Jewish community mm-hmm. on top of occupying their land and killing people. And I'm sure all of the terrible things we all know come with being occupied. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this harkens back to the Babylonian exile. It harkens back to Egypt. I mean, mm-hmm. this is the story of the Jewish people, and they're waiting and saying, when is this going to turn around? Mm-hmm. You know, when is the bad guy going to die? And so you could imagine, I think we have the benefit of 2000 years of Jesus' story and tradition to maybe soften some of that mm-hmm. cultural context, but the Jewish people didn't have that at the time. And so I could imagine Jesus just being really frustrated, but at the same time, maybe it's weeping, you know, weeping tears of sorrow that people can't get that there's another way mm-hmm. than having to rule with an iron scepter. So they all thought he was coming in and the Messiah would smash the Roman government to pieces, which he sort of did, but in a very different way.
Mm. And so that brings us to this point. You hit on this exactly, and it was my question. So what we've started doing on the show is I'm trying to throw like 30 seconds on the clock and giving Ben a very big topic because
it makes me look stupid.
not make you look stupid. It's Ben has like you have a very big brain, and I know that like if I ask you something, it ends up being
a waste
like
of space.
There's so many different directions I could go in, and how do I explain this fully? And to put you in to 30 seconds on the clock, it's very difficult for you. And since you already broached this, I will throw this at you anyways. So can a pacifist or someone that has, you know, a nonviolent way of life, can they actually watch 80s action films?
And if so,
which ones?
Should they or can they?
Can they?
Is the clock ticking?
If that's part of their ethics, so go.
If it's part, well, I don't know why they would enjoy it at that point. But there is this, I don't know. It tickles your fancy to see the, I don't know. I don't think at the beginning they probably would turn away. Like when Bambi's mother dies, they probably just didn't watch that part. So I don't know if they would get drawn into the retributive violence.
Of Bambi?
or Old Yeller. Well, that happened at the end. So, oh man, I just ruined two movies for anyone who has not seen Disney animal movies.
So, okay, so those
that
are
was
two.
An awful.
Okay, that was 30. That was your 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay, well done.
that was not well done at all.
I just like how Old Yeller and Bambi became part of 80s action flicks.
80s action, yeah.
As you're recommending
were
that.
Were they even too. Made so in those, the 80s?
Old Yeller, no. 60s. Bambi, no. I'm pretty sure of that.
The too, new so. Action genre
of that
Disney so, animal movies.
Yeah, where they'll redo them. For in a different way. Yeah. Okay, so sorry. Not
Bambi
to,
gets an assault rifle.
I just thought that they actually SNL did that where they had The Rock playing Bambi.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And I then as well, that. It was kind of funny. My kids actually wanted. They thought it was a real movie when I showed it to them. They're like, "When can we go watch this?" And it's. I had to tell them, "I'm sorry, guys. That's not it." No, but I think being able to transition from that, I'm sorry, I threw you off in a mindset with that, but you brought up 80s action films, and that was part of my impossible question for
my
Ben
fault.
Of the week, and so I thought to hold that to the end, it would have no continuity.
That's true.
But then being able to look at, I mean, I think you started talking about the, really just this deep history of the Jewish people, of how there was occupation and things of that nature, and so then when I begin to think, let's start talking about, like, really... you know, we kind of talked about, Jesus riding in on Palm Sunday. I mean, you can think of really Jesus' death on the cross being the height of nonviolence in that to be able to lay your life down for a cause, for somebody else, for other people. I mean, I think that is it. But I also want to get into this whole thing about really what he said with his mouth, not necessarily just even what he did with that. And I think that with, you know, beginning to speak to a primarily Jewish audience as like the whole, his mission and ministry did at the onset, you know, I think we come up against this whole ethic, you know, not that, but it's this whole idea of an eye for an eye, which was very, very well ingrained in the Old Testament.
Hammurabi code.
It was. And, you know, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth.
Hand for an apple.
If you
steal my apple, I'll chop off your hand.
Oh, I thought you were just like, that was like a swap
if
meet.
You grow apples on your body. No, I'm just kidding.
No, but beginning to look at that, and I begin to think of how, even if we keep talking about this counterculture movement and how the idea is of counterculture was counterculture to Rome, you know, I believe also that this whole way of life that Jesus began to speak about was totally counterculture to the Jews at the time as well, too. Mm-hmm. You know, to begin to flip that on their ear where, you know, we do have this whole idea, this law of retaliation. This is just this payback system. Which is also very 80s action films as well, too. They all had the eye for an eye. But
it really appeals to something deep within us. That's what... And that, to me, going back to the... We always go to 80s action movies on the show.
Yeah.
I think it scares me that there's some movie about... I think it was about firefighters. And there's some, like, opening scene where they're in a gas station, convenience store or something, and... It's a racially charged murder. I can't remember what happens exactly, but these people are out to like seek vengeance. And that one really got to me. I don't know why, but the racist things just really boiled up this hate in me. I'm like, oh, I want to see this guy die at this point. And it scared me. I think at that point I realized, I'm like, wow, there is something very deep and fundamental, essential in humans, I think, to want to see that retributive violence. Or it's just me. I don't know. I'm not a very violent person, but I do get angry when I'm like out in the backyard cutting up limbs and one smacks me in the face or something. Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to chip that one up like first. That limb is going to get it for smacking me in the face. So there's just something like deep within us.
You've already murdered the tree if you're at that point.
That's true.
So
poor tree.
You've already had violence upon the tree. Yeah. I guess. No, but I think that's an excellent observation to be able to look into that, to where how there is some sort of a nature where we do want justice. We do want retribution for things that have happened to us. And, you know, beginning to think of this, living like with a posture of nonviolence, it's, you know, it's even in the simpler areas, if some guy cuts you off mm-hmm. in traffic, you know, how, really what is going on within my own heart?
You just wish that the cop is right down the road.
Yeah, totally. Or that something bad happens, to him as well, too. And we have this idea within that. And I think that, again, going back to how Jesus would talk about stuff, I mean, he was all about the condition of the heart. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we were saying Zahn was picking apart this idea of patriotism being one thing of the government, and really this idea of being nonviolent is really a way of the heart. And I think that those are two very different motivators that move both of those terms within that. Because, you know, daily life, right, we're not confronted by war, but we may be confronted by people that are jerks, people that treat others poorly as well, too, because, I feel like injustice bothers me in the world, like very, very much so, and I just get very, very frustrated with that. But would I be able to deal with that injustice and do in certain ways kind of how, like, well, I mean, what we have, you know, when Jesus begins to talk about, you know, I tell you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain to the righteous and the unrighteous. So beginning to think of it in that nature, that this is really more and more about our hearts and how we walk these things out, and not necessarily what's happening around us. And I think that just kind of, I had one of those, I don't have a sound effect for something going on in my brain, like, bing, but it was...
Inconceivable!
That would work, Ben. And... No, but beginning to think about this, and I know we hit on this a lot of times, and I get pushback when I kind of poke the bee's nest of fundamentalism and stuff like that too. What begins to happen is I think that this whole way of living out of your heart, it begins to change you from the inside, and it makes less of a focus on what's going on the outside, which I think is one of those reasons that I get so frustrated of Christianity's obsession with politics. And to how it's so much changed that, where it's always about changing the world, but we don't think of it on a core level of really, how is all of this changing me in my heart? Like, how am I living on a heart level, on a community level, on a level of those around me, as opposed to just getting frustrated at the world at large? Because it's so easy, especially with the internet nowadays, you know, I can be upset about what Putin's doing in the world, though I am never going to cross paths with Putin, mm-hmm. unless I too am riding a horse shirtless in Siberia or wherever he was, I don't know.
Yeah. Or maybe not even a person from Russia.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, yeah, that's absolutely right. And this gets into, I like the contrast. We have a couple more articles here between Daniel Heimbach, his article on why I am not a pacifist, and then Stanley Hauerwas on Christological pacifism. You know, we had to bring in Hauerwas on the
always got to do that
conversation.
Yeah.
So
hop into the anti.
Yeah. So with Heimbach, one of the things I really pull out of this article, so he does, he gets into this idea that he says, you know, the short answer to why I'm not a pacifist is that Jesus was not a pacifist. He doesn't really explain that. That's frustrating to me.
But what also, just to be noted, and I'm sorry to stop you, but yeah, he is, just for his background and stuff, he is a professor of Christian ethics at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary and yada, yada, yada. Okay, so right. Keep going.
I mean, he does kind of bring in some examples later on of, you know, Jesus getting angry and rebuking people, and that... He says, you know, I come to do violence at some point. He like pulls out one scripture. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because to me, he what I call it spiritualizes it. He turns it into this sort of idea of something that really, I don't think affects us at all, except on a psychological level. Hmm. So what he says, you know, Jesus certainly is the Prince of Peace, and he quotes Isaiah and Luke, but the sort of peace Jesus offers the world is the peace of reconciling sinners to God. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to dispute that. My problem is, I think that what this does is it excuses Christians from... It's like that doesn't manifest in behavior somehow. Mm-hmm. And so all it is this idea that we're forgiven. Mm-hmm. And I guess at most we feel good about ourselves. We don't feel like God hates us anymore.
Well, and if you're thinking of from the background of being Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, I mean, we're again talking about the obsessiveness that would be about all that really mattered was the cross, dying and saving people. And then all we really focus on is finally being in heaven with God. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, it ends up kind of being one of those things we begin to talk about stuff that, you know, you could also say,
do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
That was not a correct one. So, but you can go with that. No, but actually it is. Actually, totally is. Sorry. I had a brain cramp. But no, but thinking about this, I mean, we begin to think like what you're saying when you say peace, I don't think it's what peace means in this instance. I mean, they're almost saying it in a way of justification, or something like that. And when you begin to say someone is like the Prince of Peace, you know, you are casting all of these different deep theological meanings on top of peace. And what does God speak of, especially in the Old Testament, about shalom or being like a messianic community of God? You begin to do this. And it's funny when it's just kind of like, yes, the way you say peace doesn't mean peace the way I would say peace, or even in fact, I think that the way a lot of the Old Testament says the word peace. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like he's just using it for his own, propping up his own argument.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, again, it's not really taking things as a whole. Mm-hmm. It's sort of transforming things into this idea mm-hmm. that excuses people from. It's almost like, to me, it's almost like the idea, and I'm, disclaimer, I'm not saying people should not pray. I think prayer is a mm-hmm. very great thing. It's a great discipline, and it's very powerful. What bothers me is that when people will pray in lieu of doing anything else, mm-hmm. they'll say, oh, okay, I'll pray for you. And that's all they do. Yeah. They won't, you know, it doesn't manifest in any sort of behavior at all.
Yes. You could have a close friend that has lost their job and saying, I'm really afraid I'm not gonna be able to pay the mortgage this month. And the typical response to it is, oh, I will be there to pray for you.
Right.
Whereas hopefully if you were
could
living
you pay my mortgage?
Yes. I mean, if you were living as a one in a community, and hopefully a community that would look like being, you know, a child of God in that community, that your response would be, how can I help you right now? Or not even asking that question and just simply writing a check to them. Mm-hmm. You know, if you had the means to do that, or buying them groceries, helping them out in some way, not to, you know, to where, again, I agree with what you're saying, not to say the prayer isn't important, but so often we use it as an insulator or a way to deflect the problems of the world that are happening around us, where, you know, I think that don't spend time praying for God to move when you're there and you're saying that you're a person of God and you're choosing not to do any of it, mm-hmm. you know, and so I think at that moment, I don't know what you're doing. You know, when you're going off and praying, I mean, what you're doing is you're kind of just being extractionary in how you look at it. No, and I think that too, like with, was it Heimbach? How are you saying? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Heimbach, yeah. You know, a lot of what he's getting around, again, which I think oftentimes that kind of whole Baptist conservative way of looking at things, we end up beginning to, we look at faith always through the idea, always through politics somehow. You know, it's he brings into his argument that Jesus mm-hmm. wasn't a pacifist. He begins to explain something through talking about the ethic of just war, which is almost a whole different conversation,
right.
you know, that we have here. But to begin to look at this in the ethic of just war, that's something that you're talking about on the level of nations in many ways, or the level of higher up politics or government or things of that nature, of how we... Sorry, we always get people coming by on the air and making weird gestures to us in the studio. And so, yes, sorry. No, but we say it from that level. You know, we are we are wanting, you know, I don't know, it just bothers me when we begin to negate the entire part of us that requires us living in community with people and us living out a certain, you know, ethical standard of how we live and love those in this world. And I think bouncing back towards, you know, one of these other articles, we begin just to talk about this idea of what does it look like to love your neighbors? What does it look like to love your enemies? You know, talking about stuff like that, you know, I think that they're way more powerful than being able to say, I don't know, that Jesus wasn't a passive. I feel like it's a cop-out.
Yeah, well, to me, like, even bringing in the just war conversation, I mean, what that does, I think it empowers you to become a... So your Christian responsibility with regards to pacifism or whatever is to get into a classroom and argue with people. And you spend the rest of your life writing books or whatever it is while the world goes on outside. And to me, I know that there's a select handful of people that do make giant decisions with their fingers on buttons and things like that. I don't know how much they listen to people in universities the
theological
around here.
Circles. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how big of an impact that has.
Well, and whoever people have fingers on the button, those are few and far between. If we're talking about the overall population, like of a country or our
right.
country.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But again, it excuses people from those day-to-day decisions that they make, and we all do that. And again, that's why it bothers me even using the word politics as if it's something that we don't do all the time.
Sure.
We do. And I think that kind of ties into some of what we can land with Hauerwas. So Hauerwas is reading Yoder. He's not shy about saying that he didn't come up with this strand of pacifism or this idea that he talks about in this article, but a big point for Hauerwas, a big point of pacifism is that Christ is on the cross. And to me, that would be the giant question to Heimbach. If Jesus really was okay with this sort of advantage, this military advantage or whatever you want to call it in just war, that you stamp out things when you need to, then why didn't he do it? Yeah. And he had the army of angels on his side. That's a very Baptist thing to say, right?
It is.
He had this whole army of angels.
Well, no, but yeah, are you going back to the idea?
Why didn't he stamp out the Roman government?
Or if we go back to the 80s, why wasn't he kicking ass and taking names? You know, in a way like that. And I mean, I feel like that ends up being the way that you could dance around it from a conservative circle, why that wouldn't work for him. Some of it goes back to his worldview. To where the cross was simply just about satisfying sin, the sin problem of the world. And so Jesus simply did that to satisfy the sin problem of the world is where they would say that would be their worldview of that. So it's not necessarily about being nonviolent. It's not necessarily about laying down your life for another. It's not about that. It was about this totally other thing. Even though we're operating in this weird political system, you know, of the time where it is someone, you know, refusing to fight for themselves, allowing this to happen to themselves. And it wasn't simply that he's kind of going like, I don't think Jesus was kind of going wink, wink, you know, thinking about how scripture was going to be thousands of years later and how we were going to interpret it, you know, but he was a person that was, you know, under Roman rule. He was going through a Roman system within all of this and all that comes out of it.
Right.
And so I think you can't necessarily walk away from that part.
And one of the points I think Hauerwas is trying to make in this article, which we've talked about a little bit in past episodes, is that Christology is central in this conversation. I don't know how people could deny that in Orthodox Christianity, that it's very important to understand who Jesus is in relation to God. And for people who say that Jesus is God, but that Jesus also was here, is to not excuse yourself from the human experience like we do when we say that, oh, this is just spiritual. This is just some idea that, you know, it's a psychological thing that happens or it's some sort of metaphysical thing that wipes us clean, that Jesus gets up on the cross. No, his body was hung up on a cross. There was violence done to his body. And you can tiptoe around that, but when you start doing that, you're starting to question the very theological foundations of the church at that point. I think that's kind of where Hauerwas and Yoder are.
Yeah, I think you're doing more than tiptoeing at that point. You're kind of hopscotching away. I don't know.
Right. And so, and Hauerwas brings up this idea that he's using Yoder, but nonviolence is a response to the violence of the state. It's not just a response to the nonviolence of the state, but it's a community that lives through practices of reconciliation and forgiveness. And so these sorts of things, one of the things I wanted to bring in that I did not see in here, but I love from Hauerwas, is this idea of tolerance. He does not like the idea of tolerance because tolerance assumes that two people are going to hate each other, that they're, you know, you do you and I'll do me and we won't, you know, never the twain shall meet. Mm-hmm. So it's, I hate what you're doing, but I'm going to let you do it. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to stop you from doing what you do. I'm not going to try to understand you. I'm not going to try to pierce into that and be a part of that. You do you, I'm going to do me. And, you know, we'll have a giant gap in between us.
Well, I've also heard him talk about tolerance in the way of how people will begin to say, well, my faith is something that's private to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a personal thing to me, and it doesn't belong necessarily in a public sector where it's so funny how we like to dance. We dance around wording of stuff, too. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that, again, I don't necessarily think faith needs to run politics, but I think it needs to be somehow that's ingrained in how you're just walking out and engaging the world around you.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that it's not necessarily like I have a personal, we hear this, I have a personal relationship with Jesus. So it's like, I've got a pocket pal, Jesus, and he just hangs out with me and he's like my own personal genie or something like that is kind of how it works. As opposed to saying is that how all of this affects how I live. It affects how I deal with other people in that.
And finally, just about, I know we're kind of running short on time here, but I really love this point. He says, therefore, I didn't say what the therefore is coming from, but Christian nonviolence is not a strategy to end war, though in a world of war, though, of course, it certainly wants to make war less likely. Rather, Christians are called to nonviolence in a world of war because they can do nothing less as faithful followers of Christ. So sometimes you do get into these ideas of practicality, you know, and that's one thing that I struggle with. It's very impractical to think that that war is going to end. Mm-hmm. And Howard was saying that's not really the point. Mm-hmm. The point is, in the face of violence, that we be faithful to Christ, that we be faithful witnesses to Christ and what, you know, what Christ stood for as God. Mm. And to do so is to not be violent. Mm. Whether you think that's going to end violence in the world is not the question. The question is, what am I going to do today to be a witness? And that's a witness is nonviolence.
No, I think that's very good. So as we begin to end this, let's do some rapid fire things too, because I know you're passionate about this. And so we'll just throw some stuff out on this topic, because simply put, if you're listening to this, one, we don't have all the answers. We're still kind of wrestling through things in our own lives, trying to look at different perspectives and viewpoints to make sense out of all of this. So be part of this conversation with us. And I just wanted to throw out other ways. You know, when we typically think of pacifism, we think of it really in terms of war. We don't think of it in terms of like economic violence. Mm-hmm. Systemic violence that goes on around here. We don't think of it about, you know, you'd mentioned a few shows last, like about, you know, part of being a pacifist is also just saying that, you know, there is, I mean, I don't know, what are other
domestic
like,
violence?
Domestic violence, like other types of violence. Yeah, that
pornography, that we, I mean, the trafficking industry and violence done against women to make them into, you know, bodies only and not, you know, people. And I mean, anywhere that people are made less than people or turned into animals and, you know, used in certain ways that are inhumane. I mean, all of that is violence. And I think that's definitely tied up with economics and what we spend our money on, what we click on the internet. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff is making decisions that saying, this is okay. It's okay that people are treated this way, which is, to me, is violent. I mean, you're doing violence on those people. It's a very distanced violence. You probably don't think of it in that way, but it is.
But I think we do have to think of it, even of how we spend our money. Where did that food come from? Where were those clothes made? Where were things like that happening? And I think that when you think of pacifism, we only think of it in one degree, in one arena. And I think it's much broader than that. If you're to talk about living out like a way of nonviolence in your life for that too. So, all right, as we get to the end of this broadcast, just a reminder that you can catch this episode and past ones on podcast at www.snarkyfaith.com. We love to hear from you. Questions, criticisms, we take them all. And just send it to us at questions@snarkyfaith.com.
Compliments.
And that's compliments. We'll take that too. We'll take the nice stuff. And so thanks so much. We will catch you again next week, and we are out of here.